You're saying you won't have to look at me? We finished slide 6 well enough, so I'm going on to slide 7. And we've actually already talked about this, but you see it nicely in pictures here. This is the difference between a phenotypic ratio and a genotypic ratio. And remember, there are special ratios when it comes to Mendelian genetics for a monohybrid cross. That's what we're looking at here. In a monohybrid cross for a Mendelian gene, which is simply a gene that acts in a Mendelian fashion, there is a 3-to-1 phenotypic ratio, and that's because the phenotype is either or, right? There's only two phenotypes for it to be Mendelian, right? Two traits. So there's only two categories. The ratio is just two numbers, 3-to-1. Whereas the genotypic ratio is a 3-number ratio, 1-to-2-to-1. And this just shows you what we've said already in words, that because of complete dominance, there are two different genotypes that can give you the same phenotype. Right? You can be either homozygous dominant or heterozygous, and either one is going to get you exactly the same phenotype because just one dominant allele is sufficient to fully give you the dominant trait. All right, let's go on to 8. Now, think about an organism that is dominant in its phenotype, like a pink-flowered pea plant, for instance, but it could be any Mendelian characteristic that we're talking about. If the organism has the dominant phenotype, then you can know that about it. You can say, yes, it has the dominant phenotype, but it doesn't tell you what the genotype is, right? Just by knowing that phenotype. Exactly because of what I just said in the last slide. For a Mendelian characteristic, there are two different genotypes that can give you the same phenotype. Therefore, if you look only at the phenotype, you don't know which of those genotypes led to that phenotype. And it's useful information for various reasons to know the genotype. Like, for instance, if you're breeding dogs, for instance, or breeding anything for that matter, intentionally breeding something, you want to know whether it's a true breeding dominant individual, right? And therefore can only produce dominant alleles and pass on dominance, or whether it's a heterozygous individual, right? Which is not a true breeding individual. Well, you can't tell that just by examining the phenotype. Slide 8 gives you a way to figure it out, using the pea plant example once again, with flower color as the characteristic. So if you have a purple-flowered individual, you know it is the dominant trait, but the question is it homozygous dominant, upper P, or is it heterozygous, upper-lower P? To answer that question, you conduct what's called a test cross. And in a test cross, a dominant phenotype individual is crossed with a homozygous recessive individual. Now, how do you know you have a homozygous recessive individual? Because it has the recessive phenotype. With recessivity, it is enough to just look at the phenotype, right? Because there's only one way to get that recessive phenotype, namely to be homozygous recessive. So if you look at a white-flowered individual, you not only know the phenotype, you know the genotype. And therefore, what you're crossing is either, you don't know which one you're crossing, but you're crossing either upper P with lower P, or upper P with lower P. You're trying to figure out which one of these two genotypes the purple-flowered individual is. It's one of the two. It has to be, right? You just don't know which it is. So, first, before you just do some Punnett squares as predictions. Punnett squares will give you predictions as to what would happen in the two possible cases, right? That's why there are two different Punnett squares here. Only one of them is true because only one of these phenotypes genotypes is really had by this purple-flowered individual, right? But since you don't know which it is, you draw a separate Punnett square for each of the two possibilities. This one's for the upper P, this one's for the upper-lower P. And when you look at the Punnett square results, you can see that if it's true that the purple-flowered individual is homozygous dominant, upper P, then it would be impossible for the cross with the white one to produce any white individuals. That should make sense right away, right? Because if you're a true breeding purple-flowered individual, you're definitely passing on in any gamete you make an upper P. That's all you have are upper Ps, right? And it only requires one upper P to produce purple-flowered offspring. Therefore, it doesn't matter what the white is giving you, right? So that's the prediction if it's a true breeder. If it's a heterozygous individual that you've crossed with the white one, then you'd predict half, as according to the Punnett square, half of the offspring to be purple and half of them to be white. So you just go ahead with the cross then, and you see which of these two predictions comes true. Right? Now, it doesn't have to be exactly 50-50, right? But if, as a matter of fact, if you have any white ones come out, no matter how small a number, that means this one must have been true, right? Because this one says it's impossible. But especially if you have something that will produce a lot of offspring and therefore a big number to work with statistically, it's going to be about half and half, purple and white. If it's all purple, well, then you're taking slightly a chance, depending on how many offspring there are. If it's all purple, it agrees with this and says that it's dominant. But notice that it could still be possible, just by chance, that all of the offspring would be purple for the second population as well, right? And that would be riskier and riskier for that to happen if the smaller number of individuals that it produces. Anyway, that's what the test cross does. It allows you to figure out the genotype of a dominant phenotype individual by crossing it with a recessive individual. All right, let's go to 9. Another Punnett square to look at here, but this is a little bit different. Up to now, we've talked about monohybrid crosses. This is a dihybrid cross that we're looking at. So di obviously means two, right? Whereas mono means one. Therefore, what is a dihybrid cross? Based on your hopeful knowledge of what a monohybrid cross is, what is a dihybrid cross? Okay, let's revert. What is a monohybrid cross? This you should know, because I've already told you. What does the mono, meaning one, refer to in monohybrid?
Meaning two true breeding parents.
What does the mono in monohybrid mean? What's it refer to? Not trait, but characteristic. Related, but remember, they're different. There are two traits for each characteristic. That's what makes it Mendelian. But the mono in monohybrid means there's only one characteristic that you care about. It's the only one you're paying attention to. And the hybrid part means that the two parents that you're crossing are different in their trait or phenotype for that one characteristic, which is why one of the parents was purple-flowered, the other one was white-flowered. So, based on that definition, what's a dihybrid cross? Right, a cross in which you simultaneously pay attention to two different characteristics at the same time. Now, what, in this example, are the characteristics? These pauses are hard to listen to on the recordings.
Can it be like the color and whether it's wrinkled or not?
Exactly. Seed color is one characteristic, and seed texture is the other. They're separate characteristics, but you're going to pay attention to both of them rather than ignoring all the ones except one. You're ignoring all the other ones. You're focusing on just these two. It's still a hybrid cross, though, because for each of those two characteristics, the two parents that you're crossing have different traits for that characteristic. All right, so notice that one parent is yellow for the characteristic seed color. The other one is green. And for the characteristic seed texture, one parent is smooth and the other one is wrinkled. All right, now, this is also a Mendelian case, which means exactly two traits for each characteristic. So there's only yellow and green possible for color, and there's only smooth and wrinkled possible for texture. And the dominant one, you should be able to tell just from looking at the Punnett square, but the dominant one is the smooth textured one for texture, and the yellow one is dominant over green. Okay? Now, notice the genotypes listed next to the parents. They are four characters long. That's because it's really two genotypes in one, right? There's a genotype for seed color, and that's why we're using Y here, because Y is the dominant. And so upper Y means homozygous dominant yellow. R is used here for round, and I said smooth, this book says round. But that's why R is used, it's the dominant. So YY, upper Y, upper R, is really just two genotypes in one. That's why it's four long. It has to have two Y's and two R's, though, because we're talking about a diploid, right? An individual diploid. The other one is lower Y, lower R. A double homozygous recessive, in other words. The yellow smooth one is a double homozygous dominant. Now, when they produce gametes, because they're both homozygous, and therefore true breeding, doesn't matter which one meiosis picks, right? It can pick either of the two uppercase Y's, you're going to get an uppercase Y. Either of the uppercase G's, R's, you're going to get an uppercase R. That's why there's only one type of gamete that each parent can make. The yellow smooth is going to make an upper Y, upper R. The green wrinkled is going to give you a lower Y, lower R. And remember, when I say only one kind of gamete can be produced, that means if all you care about are these two characteristics. Of course, it can make millions of different kinds of gametes, trillions and trillions, but that's when you include all the other characteristics that we're ignoring. Okay, but since it can produce only one kind, once again, you could bother to make a Punnett square here. There's not one shown, but it would be a trivial one, right? Because it's only going to be one box big. There's only one possibility. And it's going to be upper Y, upper R, lower R, right? Which means a double heterozygous individual for every offspring that these two parents make. And that's what's shown right here. This is the only type. They're all distinct individuals, of course, but they all are heterozygous for both of those characteristics. That's the F1. And notice that just like for a monohybrid cross, you expect all of the offspring to have the dominant phenotype. Well, you expect all of them here to have each of the two dominant phenotypes, yellowness and smoothness. Okay. When you then cross those F1s with each other to produce the F2, then there are two Punnett squares we're looking at. So once again, these are two different predictions, even though this is not a test cross. Two possibilities. The smaller one, the smaller Punnett square on the left, predicts a phenotypic ratio of 3 to 1. Three yellow and round, meaning three that are just like one parent, to one green and wrinkled, which is one just like the other parent. Notice that this predicts only what are called parental type offspring. Parental type offspring are offspring that are just like one parent or the other in their phenotype. All right. Now, the other one, well, before I get to that, this one on the left is what you would predict if there were dependent assortment. In other words, if there were not independent assortment. Remember what independent assortment is? The answer to that is no, apparently. What is independent assortment? It's one of the three additional sources of sexual, variation that sex brings, right? But what actually is it?
As genetic diversity to gametes.
That's what I just said. What actually is it?
Formation of random combination of chromosomes.
That's another way of saying what I just said. That's when it happens. What is it? What is the assortment word of that phrase referring to? It doesn't refer to the chromosomes. Assortment refers to how those chromosomes line up. Right. But for an individual tetrad, which is a homologous pair, how it assorts means how it lines up at metaphase, with red up and blue down, or with blue up and red down.
So it doesn't affect the other pair.
That's the independent part of the word. Independent assortment says that how one tetrad lines up is not at all affected by how the other tetrads are lining up. And that's what I'm saying here is that if we had instead dependent assortment, that would mean they all would line up the same way. All red up and all blue down, or all blue up and all red down. Okay? And if that were true, then we would have this Punnett square. Because the tetrad for the chromosome that carries the seed color gene would line up the same way as the chromosome that carries the seed texture gene. Right? And therefore, what's happening in one parent would go to the same cell as what's happening in the other. Okay, that's if there were dependent assortment. On the other hand, if every tetrad is independently assorting, then you could have the yellowness go to one cell and the smoothness go to another cell, even though they came from the same original parent. Right? They could be separated from each other because they would be independently assorting. Does that make sense? And therefore, you would expect with this bigger Punnett square all possible combinations of these four traits. In other words, you should be able to have the parental types, which are the yellow and smooth, that's one parental type, the green and wrinkled, that's the other parental type, but you should also have both what we call recombinant types, a recombination of the parental types, meaning you should also get yellow and wrinkled, and you should also get green and smooth, which both of which are not like either parent, that's why they're recombinant types. Okay, and so this has a 16 boxes simply because when you're paying attention to two different genes or characteristics at once, you have four different kinds of gametes that a heterozygous can make. Right? You pick one of the Ys, you pick one of the Rs. There's four ways you can do that. Upper, 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 lower, lower, upper, lower, lower. Okay, that's for one parent. And the same thing for the other heterozygous parent from the F1. And therefore, these are the 16 exhaustively listed ways in which heterozygotes can have their gametes matched up if there's independent assortment. Well, if you do this in reality, you can see the results here. 315 to 108 to 101 to 32. That's really damn close to what the one on the right predicts. The one on the right predicts a 9 to 3 to 3 to 1 ratio, not a 3 to 1. There's four numbers in this one because you have four different types, right? You have the parental type, both parental types, that's two of the four, and both recombinant types, that's the other two. So you get nine. There's nine ways in which you can be doubly dominant. Those are the ones that are yellow and smooth. There's three ways that you can be dominant with respect to color, recessive with respect to texture. There's three ways you can be recessive with respect to color and dominant with respect to texture. And there's only one way that you can be recessive with respect to both characteristics, wrinkled and green. Because you have to have a lower sperm and a lower egg in order for that to happen. So, the results, when you actually go through with it, match up well with this. So this is experimental evidence that assortment actually is independent. It's not dependent. I already told you it was independent, but this is experimental evidence showing you that it is. Slide 10 illustrates the fact that this is really all just probability. And so producing sperm and egg via meiosis for a heterozygous individual is exactly analogous to a coin flip, because neither one is favored. It's totally equal chance that you're going to pick from a heterozygous individual the dominant allele or the recessive allele when you make that sperm or egg. So it's like a coin flip, which means it's a 1/2 or 0.5 probability for each. And when you get an egg and a sperm together, a particular match is going to be, since both of those things have to happen, you have to have that kind of sperm, which is a 50% or 0.5 chance, and you have to have that kind of egg, another 0.5 chance, then the overall chance is 0.5 times 0.5, 1/4, which is exactly like flipping two coins or flipping the same coin twice. Okay, so these, notice, probability always has to add up to 1, which is 100%, meaning that's the whole chance, right? Which it does. Now we're done with Mendelian genetics. The rest of this chapter is about non-Mendelian genetics, starting with slide 11. And non-Mendelian genetics can happen in several different ways, but keep in mind what has to be true for it to be Mendelian to begin with. Right? What are the two major things that have to be true for Mendelian genetics to apply? What are the two assumptions? Yeah, whatever characteristic you're looking at has to have exactly two traits. And what's the molecular same way of, the same way of saying that in molecular terms is what? No, in molecular terms. What's another way of saying that the characteristic has exactly two traits? In terms of molecules, what's another way of saying that? The gene, which corresponds to the characteristic, has to have exactly two alleles, which correspond to traits. Remember, a gene corresponds to a characteristic, alleles correspond to traits. So that's one of the Mendelian assumptions. What's the other?
One trait must be dominant. Must be dominant over the recessive trait.
Yeah, not only dominant, but completely dominant. One of those two traits, and there has to be two for it to be Mendelian, exactly two, not more, has to completely dominate over the other one. So you have a fully dominant and a fully recessive one. That's what we've already been talking about all along. There's different ways that cannot be, that one or more of those can be not true, though. And that's where you get into non-Mendelian genetics. And this is why I was saying before that it was a good thing Mendel was working with Mendelian characteristics, because It would have been a hell of a lot harder to figure out his numbers if he was working with things that operated in a non-Mendelian fashion. And we probably wouldn't be using the word Mendelian named after him, because he wouldn't be famous if he hadn't figured it out. So the first of the non-Mendelian examples in slide 11 here is what's called incomplete dominance. Now just that phrase should tell you that it's non-Mendelian, right? Because I just said that one of the assumptions for it to be Mendelian is for there to be complete dominance. Incomplete is not complete. So this is non-Mendelian genetics. It's very similar to what we've already looked at, meaning that there is a dominant allele of the two, and there are only two alleles, so that is just like Mendelian genetics. What's the characteristic here? Flower color, once again, although this is a different kind of plant. So flower color is the one characteristic we care about. There are exactly two alleles only in the population. But notice that there are three traits, not exactly two. It can be red flowered, white flowered, or pink flowered. And so there is a dominant allele. The red allele is dominant over the white allele. There is no pink allele, by the way. I just said there are only two alleles, red and white. But the red dominant allele doesn't completely dominate over the white one. What that means is that, unlike the Mendelian case, in which only one dominant allele is sufficient to fully give you the dominant phenotype, for incomplete dominance, one dominant allele will give you some of the dominant phenotype, but not fully. To become fully dominant in phenotype, which in this case would be full redness, requires both of your alleles to be the red version, the dominant version. So, if you only have one, if you're a heterozygous individual, in other words, which all of the F1s will be, as you would expect, then you're only going to be partially red, which is pink. Now, think about this in terms of what all protein-coding genes are doing. Genes influence your traits only indirectly, right? They code for the proteins that you make, and the proteins give you your traits. Well, in some cases, in all cases, if you're a heterozygous individual, you only have one gene that's coding for that dominant protein, right? And so you make dominant proteins, but if you were homozygous dominant, you would have two alleles, not just one, coding for that protein, right? So you could make twice as much mRNA in a given amount of time of the same type, which could be translated into twice as much dominant protein as an individual with heterozygous genotype. Does that make sense? But depending on what that protein does, that double dose might not affect anything. So that's why the purple-flowered pea plants were fully purple, even though it's really only has the capacity to only make twice half as much, a heterozygous individual, half as much purple protein. In other cases, though, half doesn't get you the whole way, and that's what's happening here. So the red is really the red allele is the only allele here that leads to any color. If you're a homozygous recessive individual, the proteins you make do not really work to color the flower. So it remains white, uncolored. If you are heterozygous, you make a little bit of red color and it doesn't get fully red, it's pink. But if you're homozygous dominant, you make twice as much of that red stuff and it becomes fully red. This is not Mendelian though, because there's three traits to the characteristic, not just one. Okay, it's incomplete dominance, and the Punnett square is a little bit different. This in incomplete dominance, you're going to expect a 1:2:1 ratio for phenotype. One dominant to two partial to one recessive. This is also an example of a different standard. I remember I was bitching last time about the fact that they've come up with many different kinds of standards for how to code these things. So here, C, instead of using an initial for the dominant one, which would be R, we use C for all of them, which stands for color, and then a superscript, either an R or a W, to determine which allele it is. Other than that, though, it's the same thing. They could have used R and W similar. I mean, just R's, uppercase and lowercase, similarly, but they just didn't here. All right, that was one exception to Mendel. Slide 12 is another. Actually, slide 12 is two examples in one. There's two different ways that this is non-Mendelian. This is the ABO blood group in humans. Now, there are dozens, maybe even hundreds, of different blood groups that human blood is classified as. But there's only two that really we pay attention to clinically, because there's two that can kill you if you get the wrong transfusion. And those are the ABO blood group and the RH blood group. And they have nothing to do with each other, but since those are the two important ones, we usually just lump them together into one blood type. That's why you have blood type, for instance, like AB positive. The AB part of that is just the ABO blood group. The positive part is just the RH group. Totally different, but we're lumping them together. Here, we're not talking about the RH group. We're talking about just the ABO blood group. And one way in which this is non-Mendelian is that it's an example of multiple alleles. So that's the second non-Mendelian example. Multiple alleles. Multiple here doesn't mean two. Multiple means more than two. Remember, the assumption for Mendelian genetics is that there are exactly two alleles, right? For the characteristic of interest. Multiple alleles means three or more. In this particular example, it's three, but three is enough for it to be multiple alleles. It's a violation of Mendelian assumption. The alleles, by the way, are represented by genotypes with eyes. The I here stands for immunoglobulin. That's just another name for an antibody. But anyway, with a superscript or without a superscript, we use I's. The uppercase I is used if we superscript it with either an A or a B. I by itself, lowercase I, that doesn't have a superscript. And so that you have three different alleles. IA, IB, and I. These correspond to antigens that are expressed on the surface of red blood cells. Antigens are particles that can be recognized by proteins called antibodies. This is part of your immune system. Okay, so the red blood cells of any person will have either A-type antigens, B-type antigens, both, or none, depending on which alleles that person has. Now, remember that three alleles means three alleles in the population, not in an individual. An individual is diploid, so each individual has two alleles. But there's multiple possibilities when there's three available alleles in the population, right? You can have 2A, that's IAIA, and that's going to be a fully type A person. But you can also be IAI. Now, the I allele by itself doesn't code for any antigens. But the IA does. So, in a person who is IAI, the red blood cells are going to produce A only, right? Because the I by itself doesn't code for anything. Similarly, you can be IBIB or IBI. That's a type B person. Or you can be IAIB, which is a type AB person. And then the only other possibility is two I's by itself, which makes no antigens. All right, that's a type O person. Now, it's easy to understand why this is a violation of the assumption that there's exactly two alleles, right? There's three alleles, so it violates that assumption. So that's one exception. I said this is two examples, though. The other way in which, and this is a totally different reason, why this is a violation of Mendelian assumptions is that is because of what we call codominance. So multiple alleles and codominance, those are two different things, but they're both exemplified by this example. Codominance is not the same thing as incomplete dominance, so don't confuse them. What we have in codominance are two alleles, both of which are expressed, both of which are dominant in a sense. They're both dominant in the sense that it takes only one of those alleles to express the phenotype, just like in the familiar Mendelian sense, right? But for codominance, two different alleles are dominant. And therefore, in a heterozygous individual with each of these two codominant alleles, both of the phenotypes will be expressed at the same time, and they'll both fully be expressed. This is exactly how you get a type AB person. A type AB person has, you know, well, let me say that there's three alleles overall, right? But the two dominant alleles that are codominant are the A allele and the B allele. The I allele is recessive. So if you are a person who is AB, you have the type A allele, the type B allele, you have both antigens present on your red blood cells because your A allele codes for the A antigen, your B allele codes for the B antigen. So that's the codominance, right? Both of those phenotypes are expressed at the same time, but you're just as much a type A person if you're AB as a fully type A person, and you're just as much a type B person at the same time as a fully type B person. So it's simultaneous and complete expression of two different phenotypes in codominance.
So being AB, you receive either or transfusion?
Well, you have to be careful with these transfusion statements because what we're looking at here are the red blood cells. Those are carrying antigens. That's what these circles and triangles are. Antibodies are proteins that are in the plasma, which is the blood cells are part of the blood, the whole blood. But the liquid part that's outside of those cells and still part of the whole blood is plasma. And that contains, among other things, antibodies. Antibodies can recognize antigens, and they recognize them as foreigners, so they destroy them. And that's why a person who is type A, and therefore makes A antigens, will make anti-B antibodies that will recognize B as foreigners. But that person better not make any anti-A's, otherwise it will attack its own blood. And that's why a type A person can't receive whole blood from anyone other than a type A person. Now, if you spin the blood down so that you collect only the cells and leave the antibodies out, then you can...
So it's only centrifuged blood that you can do that?
Yeah, it's talking about only the cells. You can only receive cells from a type A person. If you receive type B blood cells from another person and you're type A, your own anti-B antibodies that you make will attack that new blood immediately.
But what if you're AB?
If you're AB, you can receive cells from anyone. Cells. Because you don't care whether they have A, B, or no antigens, right? Because a type AB person is not making either type of antibody. Otherwise, it would attack its own blood. But you better make sure it's only cells you're getting from those other people. Because if you receive blood from anything other, whole blood, from anything other than an AB, it's going to have antibodies in it. And either kind of antibody will attack all of your cells because you have both antigens on those cells. Type O, on the other hand, produces both antibodies, right? So they can give their plasma only to another type O person, because otherwise it will attack any kind of cell with antigens. And type O blood cell, blood people can receive cells only from another type O. Because if they receive any cells with antigens on them, their own antibodies will attack them. So when we say universal donor or universal recipient, that means of red blood cells. AB is the universal donor of plasma, right? Because it doesn't have any antibodies in it. Its plasma is safe to give to everyone. O is the universal donor of cells. AB is the universal recipient of cells. O is the universal recipient of plasma. Okay, let's go to 13 now. Another exception to Mendelian genetics. This one is epistasis, which is a word that is often mispronounced. A lot of people want to say epistasis. It's epistasis. And epistasis is gene interaction, meaning that the product of one gene will affect the expression of another gene. All right? And so there's two genes involved here. In this example, using the rats, how many characteristics are there here? No. One. What is it?
Color.
Coat color. Fur color. Yes.
Oh, okay.
Characteristic, I said. There's three traits, right? How many genes are involved? Two. How do you know that other than the fact that I said two earlier? Right, there's two types of genotypes here, right? Each genotype is for its own gene. There's the B gene and the C gene. So two genes are involved, even though we're looking at one characteristic. And epistasis, like I said, is one gene's product affecting the expression of another gene. So there's two genes both involved in this coat coloration. The B gene is the gene that codes for the color of pigment that can be put into the hairs to make them colored. And there's two different colors corresponding to the two different B alleles. There's black and there's brown. They both start with B, but the capital B stands for black because black is dominant over brown. Okay? And therefore, just if you think about only that gene by itself, it works just like the Mendelian fashion, meaning that the only way you could have brown coloration is if you were homozygous recessive with respect to the B gene, right? Lower B. Notice that every one of these brown-colored mice has lower B. Because if you have one upper B, that's going to produce blackness, not brownness. But it's not as simple as that, because regardless of which color you make, black or brown, or color that you're able to make, black or brown, another gene determines whether or not you make it at all. Okay? And that's the C gene, the coloration gene. Only if you have at least one dominant C allele, uppercase C in other words, will that pigment that you're able to be produced and be put into the hairs. And that's why it doesn't matter what's happening in the B gene. If you are double small C, then you're not going to be able to put any of that color you could make into the hairs, and you're going to be an albino, white rat. See what I'm saying there? But if you have at least one or even two uppercase C's, then it's going to depend on the B gene as to what color you put. So the one gene, the coloration gene, its product is determining whether that other gene works. And that's epistasis, which is obviously a different thing from Mendelian genetics, but it's still real. Before I forget, we're not quite to 14 yet. Let me just call this 13 and a half, because I don't have a picture for it. There is another exception I want to talk about, which is pleiotropy. Pleiotropy is the situation in which one gene simultaneously affecting more than one characteristic. Now, up to now, we've been thinking about one gene controlling one characteristic, like flower color, for instance, right? In pleiotropy, you have one gene affecting multiple characteristics, at least two. And a classic textbook example of that, and this textbook uses the example too, is sickle cell disease in humans, which we've talked about a little bit in terms of mutation. Remember when I gave you the normal wild-type hemoglobin slide on the left, and on the right was the mutant type? The sequence was exactly the same except for one nucleotide that mutated, and that is what causes sickle cell disease, because the hemoglobin is misshapen since that one amino acid is wrong. Well, that's why sickle cell disease results from that mutation. So that gene is responsible for the phenotype, which is sickle cell disease, right? That's one phenotype. And by the way, that's a bad thing to have. So you would think that natural selection would phase it out. If it's bad for individuals, if it causes them not to live long enough to pass their gene on, then you would expect natural selection to just make it die out over so many generations. And it would, except that in this case, there's a reason that it's kept in the population. In fact, it's called the heterozygote advantage. If you are completely normal with respect to the hemoglobin gene, then you certainly do not have sickle cell disease. That's a homozygous dominant individual. If you're homozygous recessive, you have both of your alleles are the mutant form, then that's what gives you sickle cell disease, which is bad. All right? But remember, there's a third possibility. You can be a heterozygous individual. And if you're heterozygous, that one normal gene that you have, that one normal allele that you have, is enough to keep you from having sickle cell disease. And the one mutant one, which is not enough to give you sickle cell disease, gives you an advantage over a completely normal person. It gives you an advantage because it will give you increased resistance to malaria. And especially in places in the world where malaria kills millions of people, that is a big deal. So the best of the three genotypes is the heterozygous individual, and that's why that mutant allele keeps getting passed on, because heterozygous individuals are passing it on. Right? But the reason this is also an example of pleiotropy is that the same gene, this hemoglobin gene, is coding for whether or not you have sickle cell disease. That's one characteristic. And it's also coding for whether or not you have malarial resistance, which is a different characteristic. So that is pleiotropy. Now, that is kind of like divergence, because it's one gene multiply affecting two or more characteristics. Divergence means splitting apart, going outward, right? In a sense, the opposite of that, which would be convergence, is what we have pictured in slide 14, which is using human skin color as an example, the exception here, which I'm saying is kind of like the opposite of pleiotropy, is called polygenic inheritance. Well, what does polygenic mean as a word? Multiple what?
Genes.
Yeah, multiple genes. That's why it's kind of the opposite of pleiotropy. In pleiotropy, one gene, multiple characteristics. In polygenic, one characteristic is being affected by multiple genes. And there's a lot of examples of this, but human skin color is a good example. When you have polygenic inheritance, instead of having just two or maybe three possible traits, like we've talked about, there's a big number of traits possible for the characteristic, and they range along a continuum, a smooth continuum between two extremes. So you can, in human skin color, for instance, it can be very light skin, very dark skin, or anything in between. And that's because it's not just a single gene controlling this. It's multiple different genes, each contributing a little bit. So it depends on how much overall contribution you have by the multiple genes as to what skin color you actually end up with. You know, we like to use the words white and black. There's no such thing as a white person. There's no such thing as a black person, right? Everyone is brown to some extent. And that's what's represented by these squares here. The little circles in each square represent the alleles. And so this it's not necessarily true that it's six genes, but the reason there are six circles in each one is pretending that there are six genes involved. Each one can be either a dark or a light allele. And the overall skin color depends on what they all add up to, basically. That's polygenic inheritance. Okay, now 15. Here we have two plants that obviously differ in their phenotype, right? Pretty clear that this one is a pink-flowered one, this one's a blue-flowered one. They're the same species, but different phenotypes. And so you might guess that it's because the alleles are different for a flower color gene, like we've already been talking about. It's the way it happens in some plants. But for these ones, these actually happen to be genetically identical. They're, well, at least for the flower color gene, I should say. They're exactly the same alleles. So how can they be so drastically different in their phenotype?
Because they're environment?
Yeah, they grew up differently. So this is the important point about genetics. Yes, it explains a lot of phenotypic, a lot about phenotype, but not everything. There are two components to phenotype, right? There's a genetic component and there's an environmental component. And just like these plants, which are genetically identical, you can separate genetically identical humans, which we know as identical twins, right? If they get separated at birth and live 90 years in different parts of the world, doing different things and eating different things, bring them back together after 90 years, they're not going to look identical, right? Even though their genes are the same. And that's because we build our bodies continuously using, you know, the genes code for what we're building, but we're building that stuff out of the stuff that is taken into our body, and the stuff that's happening to our body matters. So this is what's behind the phrase nature versus nurture. Nature refers to the genetic hand that you're dealt. That's important, but it's not everything. Nurture refers to how you actually live your life. Another example would be with the identical twins. One can sit on the couch, watch TV all day. The other one can be a bodybuilder, right? They're going to be drastically different in phenotype. But but not because of their genes. 16. What we have here is an example of what's called pedigree analysis. A pedigree is really just the genetic word for a family tree. When we were talking about test crosses, for instance, which is a way to figure out the genotype of a dominant phenotyped individual, I said you just cross them with a recessive individual, right? Well, that's all right if you're working with something that is easy to cross and that might not take very long to produce the next generation. But for various reasons, we can't do that with humans, right? There's ethical reasons. You can't just breed them experimentally. But even if there were no ethical things to worry about with humans, it would take a long time to go through several generations, right? So with humans, instead of actually performing crosses to figure out genotypes, what we can do is analyze their ancestors via pedigree analysis. Now, this is getting to be an old-fashioned way of doing things because nowadays we can just look at anyone's DNA directly. But before we had the ability to do that, you could tell a lot from the family tree. For instance, if you as an individual have a recessive trait, which means genetically you must be a homozygous recessive individual, and both of your parents are dominant in their traits, then that tells you by pedigree analysis that they must both be heterozygous, right? Because they both, in order for you to be homozygous recessive, each of your two parents had to have given you a recessive trait, a recessive allele. And since they are both dominant, they each have to have at least one dominant allele. So they had to both have a dominant and a recessive. They had to be heterozygous in order to make you. You would be just like the white flower coming back out of recession in the F2 generation. So that's what pedigree analysis is all about. But really, nowadays, we just cut corners and look at anyone's DNA right away. Speaking of looking at DNA, 17 shows you a couple major kinds of tests that can be performed to do genetic analysis, which is useful, for instance, if two parents realize that they are both carriers of a genetic disorder. A carrier, genetically speaking, is a heterozygous individual, just like the sickle cell I was talking about. The heterozygous individual would be a carrier because that person has the ability to pass on the sickle cell allele, even though that person doesn't have it, his or herself. So that can be a big deal. For if two parents realize they're both carriers, then that means there's a 1 in 4 chance that any child they have will be affected by the disorder. So during pregnancies, tests can be performed to check the genetics of the fetus or embryo. Amniocentesis is shown on the left, even though it's done later in the process. Notice that this is a fetus that we have here, whereas this one, well, they're both fetus, but this one's not nearly as advanced after the embryo stage. But anyway, in amniocentesis, it's named for the fact that a sample is taken of the amniotic fluid, which is the fluid surrounding the fetus. And since the fetus is swishing around in that stuff, its own cells are in there as well that have been stripped off just like your skin cells. So it's easy to do genetic analysis of any cells that you get. Chorionic villus sampling is really the same thing. You're getting a sample of DNA from the fetus, you're getting fetal DNA, but you're getting it, instead of from the amniotic fluid, you're getting it from the placenta, which is an interesting organ because the placenta is kind of half the property of the woman and half the property of the fetus. It's where the two share blood. It's you know, the fetus obviously is not breathing on it by itself, so it gets oxygen for, and nourishment from the placenta. But anyway, sampling that by sucking up one of these little villi, which are finger-like projections, can give you the DNA for that. Is that the last slide? Oh, no. Slide 18 and 19 end the slideshow, but these are also summary slides, and I just, like usual, I don't read these to you. I just went through all these and noticed that for pleiotropy, it did use sickle cell disease the same way I did. I just didn't have a picture for it. So that will end that chapter.